Tonight, people are watching all over the world, really, but definitely all over the nation. Sarah Palin give her speech, starting probably right about now. I love that you guys are here saying, you know what, we think that's great and everything, but we're here to study the Bible. For the sermon that Jesus gave was the speech of a lifetime. And people are asking, you know, is Sarah Palin going to come through with the speech of a lifetime? And those things are important. And you guys are all saying, yeah, Brett, we've got TiVo. Come on. You know, it's we're not going to miss it. But that's fine, too. But what I love is you guys are saying we realize the future does not lie in who the next president or vice president will be. But we believe the future will lie in what Jesus Christ said and what he did and what he's going to do. And that's why Matthew 24 is of great importance, as it speaks of future events. And man, tonight, as we look at this, I don't know about you, but I get just chills running down my spine when I read these words of Christ and realize how close we are, how the imminent return of Jesus, or at least the imminent rapture of the church, it could happen any minute, any second. And it makes me live this life with great hope and anticipation. And man, I hope that if we do one thing tonight, I hope we can go away saying it's time to be ready, watching, waiting, not to be the wicked servant the Bible describes who's just saying, ah, the Lord's not going to come back right now. It's not going to happen right now. That's the evil servant the Bible talks about. I want to be that servant saying it could be at any moment. Oh, come on, Brett. Pastors and preachers and Christians have been saying the Lord's going to come back and rapture his church out. They've been saying that for centuries. Are you kidding me? You think it's going to happen in your time? You know, people say that, but you know what? I'd rather go down with all those great preachers and pastors of old who thought the Lord could return in their day and lived their lives that way. That's what I want to do. And if I die and the rapture of the church doesn't happen before then, count me in with, you know, all those other great preachers and ministers who preach that message. That's the point. The Lord wants us to live with an end times mentality. He wants us to be end times believers, even if it doesn't happen in our lifetime, which I really do believe it's going to. We still need to live with that anticipation. You'll see what I mean as we get through this, if we get through this. Verse 1 of Matthew 24. By the way, this is called the Olivet Discourse. Now, Lord willing, we'll get into some of this. There's actually, some people say, three versions of this same sermon. Matthew chapter 24 right here, of course, and maybe if you have a marginal reference Bible, it marks Mark chapter 13 and Luke chapter 21. All speak of this Olivet Discourse. Now, the big question is, are they the same exact sermons at the same exact time? You see, when you read Matthew 24 and Mark chapter 13, they align very reasonably. The debate lies in Luke 21 and Matthew 24. And if we have time, maybe not tonight, but maybe next week, we'll see if we get into all that. Some of the controversy that swirls around Matthew 24, Luke 21, and the comparison of those two sermons. Some even argue that they weren't even the same discourse. But some people maybe erroneously call it the Olivet Discourse, both of them being one and the same. Not sure about that. But we'll get into that maybe as we proceed. So the Olivet Discourse, at least Matthew 24, everybody agrees this is the Olivet Discourse. And Jesus went out, verse 1, and departed from the temple. And his disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. We referenced this on Sunday. Look how these beautiful buildings of the temple are standing, Jesus. Almost as if he hadn't seen them somehow before. And so Jesus is getting the tour. Have you ever been given a tour of something you already have seen? You're trying to act sort of interested, like, oh my, wow, that's amazing, ooh. And you know, well, Jesus doesn't try to act that way. For it says, verse 2, Jesus said unto them, see ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. So not only was he not acting impressed, he was just saying, all this stuff's coming down. It's temporary. And you know, really, it is an interesting thing to think about, because this did happen. Question, what year, hopefully we're all getting this by now, what year did this happen? 70 AD, right. Vespasian was told to conquer Jerusalem, and so he sent the Titus and all that went down there. And you've heard me talk about that. That's an important date. AD 70 is huge historically for the Jews, but also for the whole world. That's when this prophecy that Jesus gave to these disciples was fulfilled perfectly. Not one stone was left upon another for the reason of the Roman soldiers. When they say, in fact, Josephus talks about how it was accidentally burnt down by the Romans. They didn't mean to burn the temple. But a stray arrow, or some people argue that it might have been a torch that was lit off the inside of the temple. And all those inside tapestries and everything got so hot and burned, it melted all the gold. And the gold seeped into the cracks of those giant stones that were the ones I tell you about the size of a school bus. So the Romans, when everything cooled, they turned every rock upside down with their armies and pulled the gold out of that temple. And it made so that not one stone was left upon another. And one of the cool recent archaeological digs, if you went to Israel, 20 years ago, you wouldn't have seen these. But near the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, you can go through this little gateway and walk down this little area where some digs have been done in recent years, where they found that these Roman soldiers took these giant stones of the temple and hurled them over the wall, and they're just piled up in giant rubble down below. And they actually found those stones that were part of that temple archaeologically. So it's pretty amazing. It's history alive when you go to Jerusalem and see that. Now, just a little bit of personal application here too. Jesus was trying to get the disciples to understand something. Do you think he was just trying to burst their bubble? Oh, you guys think this is really special, the temple? Well, let me tell you what. It's coming down. It's all going to be a bunch of garbage. So take that. Is that what he's saying? No, I believe Jesus was wanting these guys to have an outlook. He was wanting to have them be men who were not saying, wow, look at this trappings. Look at all this religiosity. I would argue that Jesus was one of the most, I should say it this way, he was one of the least religious people that ever walked the face of the earth. Jesus, who did he come down on? Was it the sinners, the publicans, the harlots, the tax collectors? He seemed to have great mercy and compassion for the sinner. But the people that he was constantly seeing correcting and even being pretty brutal, like we saw last week in Matthew 23, where he called the religious scribes and the Pharisees, you whitewashed tombs, you're open sepulchers, you're hypocrites and fools. And Jesus was brutal on those guys. Why? Because they were misguided and they were misleading the people. And they were ripping off the people. And Jesus had a lot to say about religion in those days. But be that as it may, he's saying, guys, it's not about this temple as much as it's about what's going to happen in the future and what I'm doing and what the Lord, the Father in heaven has going on. And really, in the same way, we could make that same application. Even as I referenced our building project, one of the reasons why I don't mention that at church very much is I really don't want it to take a big center stage here at Athey Creek. People say, how are you going to pay for it if you don't mention it or do the old give till it hurts rap on Sunday morning? And the reason I don't do that is because I would rather just be at the school and talk about Jesus and how he's coming back soon and lead people to Christ that way. But Brett, what if the school tells you tomorrow that you can't meet here anymore? I don't have the foggiest idea. I'd have to say, sorry, you guys, I can recommend a good church over there. And, I mean, truly, that is one thing we have to think about, is the school could shut us down. We leave a big print here on Sunday mornings, on Wednesday nights. We pack this place out. Soccer people are upset that we're packing up the parking lot, even though we're the ones paying for the parking lot. They're not. We are. And we do have juggling issues that we have to kind of mess with. But the one thing I love about being in a school is nobody's saying, wow, look at our building. They're saying, oh, in fact, it's almost funny sometimes. Have you ever experienced this? I have, I did a wedding the other day and this lady came and said, oh, I've heard you on the radio and your voice, I recognized it. No, man, where's your church? And I said, well, actually we meet in a junior high school. She went, oh. And she turned around and walked away. And it is funny how sometimes that sort of take, oh, that's not a real church because they meet in a school and someday. Honestly, this is as real as it gets if you ask me. Coming into a borrowed building, that's what Jesus did. He borrowed everything. And so here we are, and as long as this holds out, I'm really happy. and buildings are expensive and kind of more of a nuisance if you ask me. Now, what we're building over there is tilt-up concrete, as much of a warehouse as we can build it. It's going to have a roof overhead and there's certain requirements the state has us do to make it very occupiable. But all that said, we're doing it as cheap as we can, which is still not cheap, by the way. And all that, it's like, man, Lord, you're going to have to just do this. And that's one of the things I love about that is it's not about our trappings or our religiosity or the things that we have. One of the things you study in church history is you see this pattern. What happens? There's first of all a movement of the Lord. The Lord starts to move in a town, a place. Study church history. Some of the great revivals and church movements in history. It started out with a movement of God. And then suddenly a ministry was stirred by some, usually a man. Sometimes it starts, the man is called to ministry. Then there's this movement. Man, ministry, movement. And that's all good. But then suddenly, after years of that movement and the Lord being glorified and people coming to Christ, it becomes this big, big movement. To the point where they start to build a monument, the Crystal Cathedral, or some giant church or some building. What's amazing, if you go to Europe, you see all these monuments sprinkled all over Europe, beautiful, giant chapels and churches that were set there because God was doing a work 100, 200, 300, 800 years ago. But if you go to many of those churches on a Sunday morning in Europe today, there's 10 people in a congregation room that would seat 500. What happened? Well, see, that's what scares me a little bit as a pastor. And that's why we're not building a great monument to Athey Creek Christian Fellowship. We're going to build kind of a warehouse. Why? Because, if we closed our doors, we could turn it into a bowling alley, or they could, make rubber stamps there or something. It really is just going to be a kind of a normal building, nothing really flashy. Why? Because I really don't want the next one. I gave you three ends. First the man, then there's a ministry, then there's a movement, but then it becomes a monument to what God has done. And it sounds so good and noble at first, but once it becomes a monument, shortly thereafter it becomes a mausoleum. And I don't want that ever to happen. And so we got to watch out for that. And so while we're here at the school, I feel fairly safe, but be praying about that. Yes, we need a church building because it's just, we're busting out of the seams. And we could lose this school at any moment. But at the same time, it's a necessary thing, but I don't want it ever to become the thing. That's the kind of the important thing. Now, that's on a corporate church level lesson from this Jesus saying, this temple's going to be torn down. It's no big deal. What's really important? In the same way, your own life personally, if you're not careful, you can see that happen as you get older. When you're a teeny bopper, man, you don't have a monument. You don't have a movement necessarily. You don't have a ministry as much. But then you get older and pretty soon you're successful in your career and you get your house, the monument, and the car, monument, miniature monument. And you get kind of this thing set up and it's all about the trappings. And if we're not careful, we can make the same mistake the Jews made in making the big temple and saying, oh, this is it. When really life is not about the house and the car and our monuments we build up to ourselves. It's actually about the Lord and Him alone. So really we can learn personally from this little lesson Jesus just gives us, this little snapshot. We can learn corporately as a church from this. But in those days, the disciples were going to have to learn that it wasn't about that big temple. It wasn't the big thing. Interesting, the Jews, and really Christianity, hasn't learned a lesson at all from this. One of the most disappointing things for me when I go to Israel with a group is to see all the monuments and all the things they build and the gaudiness. I mentioned when we got back from our last trip from Israel how I allowed our group to kind of compare and contrast. What did we do? Well, we went to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Now the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, I've been there before on a few occasions, but on our tour groups, I generally avoid that, and I'll tell you why. I don't believe it's the place where they buried Christ. That's just my personal opinion, and I've got archaeological things I could talk about of why I back that up. But most of Christianity, all of Catholicism, they believe that that's where Christ was buried. So when you go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, it's packed full of people. And you walk in and there's people kissing the marble stones where they believe that Jesus was laid. And it's so kissed that it's worn down into a pocket. And it's like everything's just worn out from people kissing and hugging and all that stuff. And man, it almost kind of turns my stomach when I get in there and I just kind of go, oh man, it just doesn't, this isn't what Jesus would have wanted. So then after that, we marched through this this part of Jerusalem that wasn't part of my plan, but we marched through this place. It took us a while marching through this this little market area that was elbow to elbow people. And we made our way through, and finally we got to the Garden Tomb, which is where I personally believe Jesus very likely could have been buried. And it's a very different place, and there's reasons why there's people that believe that's the place. But what's so cool about it, that nobody built, you know who took it? The British. Years and years ago, the British kind of purchased that land. And they've set it aside, and they didn't build a giant cathedral over it. There's no hanging incense lanterns. There's no crosses carved into this or that. It's just this garden, which is interesting because that's where Jesus' tomb was in a garden. And it's near this hill that looks like a skull. And it's just this kind of cool thing that these little British guys run over there. And it's awesome. And that contrast was simply, it wasn't even about the garden tomb. It was about, hey, Jesus died and he rose again. And the British guys are saying, this might be the place, but that doesn't matter. Jesus is alive. And we're all like, oh, thank you, Lord. This is what it's really about. And may the Lord help us not to say, oh, it's about Athey Creek and our activities and our worship team and our children's ministry and all our ministry around the world and missionary. It's all about, no, it's about Jesus and him alone. And we got to keep our focus on him. Amen? Amen. Verse 2. No. Verse 3. Yeah, see, I'm telling you what. Verse 3. So, as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? What would make the disciples ask this question? Most scholars agree that when Jesus talked about the destruction of the temple, they viewed that temple as such a permanent structure. And the thought of that temple, 17 stories in height, built, rebuilt by Herod the Great, this massive temple seemingly immovable, unshakable, they thought Jesus is talking about the end of the world when this temple comes down. Although it wasn't the end of the world, it was a very bad time in the history of the Jews, AD 70, but it made them think about the end times and the end of the world. Now, just a sideline note, who was there? Well, you say the disciples were there listening to Jesus talk about this discourse on the end times. But actually, we know that it was Peter, James, and John, and Andrew. There were actually only four disciples there, and we get that from the other accounts in the gospel. So it was only four of these disciples hearing this little discourse on the end times. So interesting, kind of that inner circle plus Andrew. Peter, James, and John were there, the rising of Jairus' daughter and Garden of Gethsemane, but Andrew's included on this one too. So it's kind of, you got to picture this fairly intimate little scene there, maybe even in the Garden of Gethsemane, because that's on the Mount of Olives. That's where Jesus would oftentimes hang out. And so they're sitting on the Mount of Olives, looking over Jerusalem, and they're saying, Jesus, when are these things going to happen, the end times and the end of the world? And now Jesus is going to give one of the most radical discourses in all the pages of Scripture. And this discourse, by the way, is perhaps the pinnacle of Bible prophecy in the New Testament. Some people say, well, the book of Revelation's got to be that. But the book of Revelation, I believe, is very huge prophetically in the New Testament. But without Matthew 24, we get a little bit of gaps in our understanding of what's going to happen. Jesus is going to sort of give us another key to unlock another door in this puzzle of Bible prophecy. By the way, while we're on that topic, do you understand? This is important. Bible prophecy is the one discipline in Bible study that will sort of change as we get closer to that time. The Bible tells us that. It's not that it's changing, it's just that our understanding of it will increase and sort of evolve as the Lord just gives us key after key and unlocks door after door to the point where actually the Lord returns. Daniel gets kind of a glimpse of this, a snapshot of this, when in Daniel chapter 12, Daniel was many times just confounded by the prophecies that he was given. And he would scratch his head and say, Lord, what's going on? And the Lord would say, Daniel, it's not really for you to understand at this point. Like in Daniel 12, where God says, Daniel, just seal up the words of this book until the time of the end. Seal it up. In other words, you seal it up. It's not really even for your time. You're not going to understand it. And many times you see Daniel at the end of the prophecy that he writes down, he falls flat on his face, confounded. And then he gets back up and goes around about the king's business. Now, this is cool because you might say, Brett, Bible prophecy confounds me today. Well, I'd encourage you to be like Daniel. Understand whatever you can and then get up tomorrow and just do what you normally do and get out there and serve the Lord. Go about the king's business, like it says of Daniel. But here's the cool thing. I believe we are way more close to the right understanding of how it's all going to come down today than we were even 20 years ago. It's the one area of Bible study that will get our understanding will increase on these things. The end of the book of Revelation says, do not seal up the words of this book. So it's kind of an interesting thing how we're seeing these things unfold. Now, why do I say that? Why do I even spend time with that? Well, there are schools of eschatology, that is the study of end times, that one of their pillars of their arguments as to why they believe and what they believe, it's a group called the amillennialist. Ah means no. Millennial means it's 1,000 years. They believe in no millennium. And they don't take really the Bible literally when it comes to Bible prophecy. Sort of a subgroup of that is the preterists. And we might even talk about them tonight a little bit. The preterists are those who do not take the Bible literally, but they believe it's all allegorical. It's more figurative. And so you don't take Bible prophecy literally. Which, to me, well, I should not get it. I could argue that part. I'm not going to do that yet or now. There's other times we've done that. But all that to say, one of the reasons that's important is because those guys, their number one pillar, one of their pillars, I should say, is that our view of Bible eschatology or end time study is the oldest view out there. We believe this for centuries and millennia, which to me is a good argument as to why not to follow that school of Bible prophecy. Let me just tell you this. I would have been an amillennialist had I lived 500 years ago. Because to say that all these end times Bible prophecies would come to pass, you'd look at the world scene and what was going on with the Jews and the people that were called God's chosen people. You'd say, yeah, all of this doesn't really matter. The Jews are kind of done. God's no longer working with the Jews. They're not even anywhere really on the earth anymore other than just little pockets sprinkled around the world. And so we have replaced the Jews and God is working through his church. I can understand how they would have believed that back in the day. But some of those views of allegorical interpretations of Bible prophecy should have been shut down, absolutely shut down, May 14th, 1948, when Israel became a nation again, where the Jews, and even in the early 1700s, and then on, the Zionist movement, the Jews started flooding back into Israel. And Israel was given their homeland by the world. They were given their homeland by God. And even now, they're one of the most prosperous nations in the world. Israel. You can't say, when the Old Testament said that I'm going to scatter you all over the world, and then I'm going to have all of Israel come back and make of them a mighty nation. The amillennials said that was actually when the Lord would make his church gathered. And he would gather Christians and not the Jews. But once God literally did that, that should have shut it down. Now since 1948, hundreds of other prophecies have come to pass. Exactly what the Bible said. Point for point, literally, not allegorically, not figuratively. And to be an amillennialist today, you almost have to stick your head in the sand and say, I deny that Israel actually is really a nation. And I deny that they're trying to divide Jerusalem in half today, just like Zechariah 12, Zechariah 14 tells us. I'm going to deny that these things are literally happening because I'm an amillennialist. You have to really throw reason out. Now, I say that carefully because some of my amillennialist friends who I very much like and guys that know the Bible, I'm not saying these guys aren't Christians and don't be angry about these guys. There's a lot of good people who are amillennialists who are going to go to heaven. Just when the rapture happens, they're going to change their notes on their way up if they have time. And they'll realize that they were a little bit off on that. But that's okay. Now here's the thing on that. All this discussion about end times, this is not necessarily one of those essential doctrines of the Christian faith. And I want to make that clear right out of the gate. You know, did Jesus die on the cross for our sins? Yes, that's an essential doctrine. Is Jesus God? Yes, that's an essential doctrine. These are doctrines that divide Christians from non-Christians. End times theology should never be that where we sit there and say, well, that person's not a Christian because he's a mid-trib or a post-trib or a mill or sawmill or whatever. That should never be a dividing, cutting factor, okay? So make sure and understand that. And you say, well, Brett, you seem pretty passionate when you talk about pre-trib rapture. And the answer to that is yes, I am. And I'll tell you why. I'm really excited about this. I really do look forward to the time where the Lord takes us out and brings us to heaven. And even Luke, we might even see this coming up if I ever get through this. In Luke 21, it says, pray that you be counted worthy to escape these things. What things? The stuff we're about to read here in Matthew 24, the same stuff we read in Luke 21. We want to be counted worthy to escape these things. So it's good news, and I am passionate about it for that reason, but also it changes the way you live. Pre-trib, that is believing that before the tribulation period happens, the rapture of the church is going to happen. Those of us that believe that, it's the only view that allows for imminence. Imminence? Yeah, it's just not knowing when Christ is going to return. You see, if you're a mid-tribber, you know exactly when the Lord's coming because the Bible tells us that the midpoint of the tribulation is actually going to happen to the very day. And that's an event called the abomination of desolation. We'll get into that in just a minute. So the mid-trib, you know when the Lord's coming back. If you're a post-tribber, you can also know the day and the hour. Because the Lord even not only gives us the midpoint of the tribulation, but he counts to the end of the tribulation, you know, the 1,240 days, you know, of half of 3.5 years. He nails it down to the day. If you're a post-tribber, you can say, well, the Lord can't come back until the abomination of desolation, and then 3.5 years after that, then we are raptured. If you're a post-tribber, imminence goes out the window. Same with mid-trib. Same with pre-wrath, those of you that are Bible students, the only view that believes the rapture could happen at any point, nothing has to happen today in order for the rapture to happen right now, is the pre-trib view. That's an important one. And that's one of the reasons I believe it's so important to believe in pre-trib, because it changes the way you live. If you and I truly knew the Lord cannot come back today, which post-trib, mid-trib, pre-wrath views, you have to say he can't come back today because the abomination of desolation hasn't happened yet. You know, all these signs of the tribulation period haven't happened yet, so we have to wait for those. And the Lord is delaying his coming until those times. Ooh, did I say delay is coming? Who is it that said the Lord's going to delay his coming? The wicked servant. We're going to see that in Matthew 24. So I don't even want to get close to that. I want to be a pre-trib rapture view because I believe it's biblically sound, because it's something to have hope in, but also it changes the way you live. If you believe the Lord could come back right now, you're not going to go to Jiggles after church. You know what I'm saying? It's just something you will not do if you believe the Lord's coming back. In fact, 1 John chapter 3 says this, that he who has this hope purifies himself. The hope of Christ's imminent return, there's a purifying effect. If we really believe Christ's coming back any moment, you're not going to be partying down or doing all the stuff if you really believe that. So to me, those are just some simple reasons why pre-trib. Now, those aren't my arguments as to why I believe in pre-trib. They're just reasons why I really like pre-trib. And if you hear a passion in my voice, it's because of those three things. But be that as it may, verse 4. Oh, boy. What shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world? And Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. Now, if you missed Sunday, we went over this first section on Sunday about these signs that Jesus is going to give us. And we went through several of these signs. One of which is these people who claim to be the Messiah that say, I am Christ. And we talked about how historically there's been a bunch of people, hundreds of people who've claimed to be Christ in history. Not just the crazy guys down at Portland downtown who are saying, I am Christ, I am the Messiah. There's actually figures in history that people, thousands of people or even tens of thousands of people actually followed that they believed were actually the Messiah, but it was not. They came after the true Messiah. So this is something we see coming to pass, those that would say that I am the Christ. Now, verse 6, and ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled. Would you mark that, by the way? See that you be not troubled. Christians, you know, we get all perturbed and freaked out when we see the news. In fact, if you're one who's a news junkie, that's okay. I tend to be that a bit too. But at the point where your blood pressure starts to boil, turn it off, shut it down, read your Bible. You know, if you listen to Sean Hannity or Rush Limbaugh, you know, that might get you riled up. But if you flip over to, what is it called? The Progressive Talk of 620 Portland, Oregon. If you listen to that, your blood, you know, if you listen to both of these stations, Rush Limbaugh on one hand and then the 620 on the other, you know, you'll blow a gasket. It's crazy, all the talk. And you know, honestly, it's not of the Lord. Well, which one, Brett? True Talk, or whatever, Progressive Talk Radio and 620, or Rush Limbaugh, which one? Both. They are not of God. Well, how do you know that, Brett? Would you flip over to, I'm getting off course here, but. 1 John, turn there with me real quick. 1 John, this is a good way to see if something's of God or not of God. I call it the sieve. I've shared this with you before, but this is a life section of scripture for me personally, and I like to share this. Because, you know, a lot of things we see and do in this world, we wonder, is this of the Lord or is it not? If Jesus were standing here with me right now, would this be okay? Or should I shut it down? This is the sieve. You can run through those things. Check it out. 1 John chapter... James chapter 3. I don't know. Oh, I know. I was talking about 1 John on the purifying. 1 John 3, that's the purifying section. But James chapter 3 is the sieve. It says here in James 3:13. Who is a wise man endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation his works with meekness and wisdom. But if you have bitter envying and strife in your heart. Uh-oh. Do any of those radio programs cause strife in your heart? Glory not, lie not against the truth. This wisdom descends not from above, but is earthly, sensual, and devilish. For where envying and strife is, there is confusion in every evil work. And quite frankly, even some of those guys on the radio that I agree with, even though I listen to them and agree with them, they cause strife in my heart. And I'm not sure that's really the things that are of the Lord. But check this out, verse 17. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated or enacted, full of mercy and good fruit, without partiality, without hypocrisy. The fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. You see, quite frankly, I know that the religious right tends to jump on the bandwagon of the different radio announcers and all that stuff. And I think the religious right, a lot of time, maybe even most of the time, is religiously wrong. Because there's strife and there's envy and there's this devouring and biting. And man, I don't see that really being part of what Christianity is. Christianity should be meek, humble. Look what it says here. If it's peaceable, is it peaceable? Are you a peacemaker? In fact, Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers. You know, pretty much all those radio programs are not making peace at all, but they're declaring war. And I believe we as Christians need to be real careful about these things. Especially as we get to these end times, are we surprised that there's wars going on in the world? Are we surprised people are turning towards sinful things and attitudes? Should we be shocked when people are hypocritical in what they believe and what they say? And sadly, we get sucked right in. And really, we need to put our guard up. So, be not troubled, verse 6 of Matthew 24, back here at Matthew 24. See that you be not troubled. That's important for you to understand. Some of you might be troubled because of all the stuff that's going on in the world. Others of you might just be freaked out. I don't like end time stuff because it's spooky. The answer to that, by the way, is to remember what the whole purpose is. Christ's return, when he comes for us, the rapture of the church, Christ's return, those two events are going to be amazing events that are going to change our lives forever for the better. And this is as hard and as bad as it's going to get. It's going to be good. Well, Brett, I don't know if I'm going to be saved and raptured in the church. I think I might get left behind because I said something mean to my wife today. Or I kicked the dog or did this or that. Am I going to get raptured? Hey, remember, You're saved by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. So if you're a Christian, if you've confessed Christ, if you're walking with the Lord, what a cool thing it is to know that all this stuff is going to be good. So we can let not our hearts be troubled, like Jesus said. We cannot, as it says here, allow ourselves to be troubled. In fact, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and 5, which speaks of the rapture specifically, and chapter 5 says, both of those chapters say, wherefore, comfort one another with all these words. What words? Words about the rapture of the church and about the end times. Comfort one another with these words. So if what I say tonight scares you, somehow you're either not hearing it rightly or I'm saying it wrongly. We need to be comforted. Those that are truly Christians in this room, the things that we're talking about tonight should not trouble you, but it should be a comfort to you. And I know sometimes I can forget that people are actually freaked out about wars and rumors of wars. I kind of think that's kind of what's been going on for a long time in this world. So really, when I hear about injustice and people getting away with murder, at the same time, other people going to jail for building a shed on their back part of their property and breaking building codes. Do you know there's a guy that got 26 years in prison because he took a wetland, poured sand in it, and built a house on it, and he didn't have a proper permit for it. Got 27 years in jail for that. No room for parole. Then you hear about other stories where a guy lights his son's bed on fire and kills his son, and he gets, you know, the sentence, but he got out in 6 years. You know, you wonder about justice and what's going on. People can, you say, well, that's troubling, Brett. But see, to me, the more I realize that someday Christ will come and rule and reign on this earth, that's when justice will be served. That's when rightness will be brought in, an everlasting righteousness that's not going to be temporary. So we look forward to these things. We're not troubled by these things. That's the key. So be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. 4 verse 7, nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Remember the word sorrow is odin in the Greek, birth pains, as a woman in travail, laboring in childbirth. We talked about that on Sunday. Verse 9, then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another. And many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many. And because of iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Now, this section that we've just read, again, if you missed it on Sunday, there might be some blank spaces in here, but you can pick up the MP3 or the CD in the back. But this is the first section of three in this Olivet Discourse. Now, this is where people get greatly confused. Jesus is addressing us in this discourse in a three-point sermon or a three-point discourse. And this first group, we see, as you look at it contextually, he's talking to the nations of the world. This is important for you to see because he will be addressing different groups in this chapter. And we'll see this and divide them and see why we divide them. This first group, though, it includes us today. It includes the Jews. It includes all the people of the world of all time. This is the way it's going to come down. And what we're seeing is the beginning of sorrows. We're seeing what verse 8 says. All these things are the beginning of sorrows, the travail, the childbirth pains. So that, if you would, just mark verses 1 through 14 as the end times as it relates to the nations. The end times as it relates to the nations. Now, the next section is going to be the end times as it relates to Israel. And this is a very key point, and we'll see why it's speaking to Israel. And then the third section, and by the way, the end times as it relates to Israel goes from verses 15 to 36. And then from 37 to 42 speaks of the end times as it relates to the church. So let me go over that just real quick again so you can get it. First of all, verses 1 through 14, the end times as it relates to the nations. Verses 15 through 36 is the end times as it relates to Israel. And then verses 37 through 42 is the end times as it relates to the church. Now, the reason that's important is because on this pre-trib, post-trib, amillennial, preterist, all the different views, this is the battleground, by the way. Matthew 24, this is where much of that battle is fought. And I believe we have to look at who Christ is talking about, who he's talking to, and that makes it so much clearer, and it's easier to understand if you'll simply realize who's the Lord talking to. It's clear, that first section, he's just talking generally to the nations of the world about all the things that will come upon the earth and upon the nations. But now we're going to see something that's very Jewish. It's a topic that is very Jewish, and all the Jews listening to Jesus would know this is something that specifically is linked to us. And it's something that is not necessarily linked to or ever in the context of the church. And we'll see what we mean right when we get out of the gate here in verse 15. It says, "When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand." Question, did you read this right now? You just read it. So the Lord's saying, understand this. He's saying, you better, if you read it, you're responsible now to understand this. So you really should probably tune in at this point, because it's very important. He says, if you read this, let them understand. Then, verse 16, let them which be in Judea flee to the mountains. And we'll talk more about what kind of fleeing is going to happen. But first, we got to figure out what in the world is Jesus talking about. Sounds like a bad movie, The Abomination of Desolation. By the way, the guy with the voice, you know, the Geico voice movie, he died this week. Very tragic, in a world. That guy, you know, that, and, but when I read that abomination of desolation, I always pictured his voice, you know. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation coming soon to a theater near. No, it's actually coming to Jerusalem in the future. Now, you say, wait a minute, Brett, I'm confused. The abomination of desolation. It's spoken of by the prophet Daniel, it says here. And if I recall, isn't the abomination of desolation back when there was some guy that slew a pig in the temple and somewhere in 160-something B.C.? And wasn't that the abomination? Yes. Was it spoken by Daniel? Mm-hmm. But Jesus is saying, when you shall see. In other words, that was way before Christ came. Now Jesus is talking about an abomination of desolation that you're going to see in the future. Does that mean there's two abominations of desolations? What's going on there? Well, the confusion is understood, but this is a really kind of a cool thing about Bible prophecy. It's oftentimes like an onion, layer upon layer. Bible prophecy has picture upon picture. Sometimes there's dual fulfillments of prophecy, which helps us understand this mysterious unfolding of future events. Christ is giving us another key. Up until Christ said this, it would be understood why people would think the abomination of desolation kind of happened already. What do you mean? Well, let me give you a little commercial break, because the abomination of desolation is kind of a heavy thing. But let me just tell you one thing that I love about this. When I was in college, the number one book that was ridiculed by my college professors in the secular school that I went to was the book of Daniel. Secularists, atheists, people who are against the Bible, hate the book of Daniel for a real reason. The reason being, Daniel's prophecies are so exacting that virtually all of the secular academia claims that it's a forgery, that it really wasn't written by Daniel at all, but it was written by some other guy. And many argue that it actually was written, the book of Daniel was written in A.D. 90. 90 A.D. Well, here's the funny thing about that. That was a hugely controversial thing. There was a guy by the name of Porphyry who was one of the higher critics of the Bible. Wasn't very higher at all, but he actually was always saying the book of Daniel is a forgery. Now why, by the way, was Daniel considered a forgery? Because after the Babylonian Empire, the Bible predicted through the prophet of Daniel that after the Babylonians, then would come the Medes and the Persians, then would come the Greeks led by Alexander the Great. And he's talked about very specifically in what he would do and how he would capture and really conquer the whole world. And then it talked about the Romans and those nations that would come right after Babylon. So the Babylonians, the Medes, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, in great detail. So that the critics of the Bible said there is no way some dude like Daniel could have written the book of Daniel. Thus, it must be a forgery. That's their logic. That's their thinking. But here's what's great. One of the greatest finds archaeologically in the world was fairly recently. Back in 1947, the Dead Sea Scrolls were found there in Qumran Caves, another place we go in Israel oftentimes when we visit. And there, that place at Qumran, they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they predate the time of Christ by at least 100 years. And so what's so cool about the Dead Sea Scrolls is it proves that porphyry was wrong, and it definitely wasn't 90 AD when Daniel was written. So we know that. But here's another thing that's kind of cool. The Septuagint. Now, what's the Septuagint? It's the Greek translation of the Old Testament. We know when the Septuagint was originally written. That's easy knowledge. Even the secularist knows this. But it dates 200 plus years BC. 233 years before Christ came, the Septuagint came, which includes some of the prophecies, many of those prophecies that Daniel talked about. And so Porphyry and those guys, it's so fun just to shoot down the college professors. Listen, you guys that are going to college, if anybody challenges the book of Daniel and they say, Daniel was a forgery, it was written in 90 AD, they're still saying that in these college classrooms at Portland State, at Oregon State, they're still saying it. You guys just say, what about the Septuagint? Because Daniel is word for word in the Septuagint, and it predates Jesus' time by more than 200 years. And they'll sit there and, for some reason, they haven't thought about that one. And it's so simple, and it's so cool, and these guys have been saying this stuff for years. Man, shoot it down. Don't let them get away with that. Now, here's the thing. You say, Brett, why are you talking about the authenticity of Daniel? Because I think there's actually a third and finest of arguments. And that is right here in our text. It says here in verse 15, when ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, Jesus did us a huge favor here. Jesus said those words about the abomination of desolation in Daniel chapter 8, Daniel chapter 9, Daniel chapter 11, and Daniel chapter 12, all mention the abomination of desolation. All those chapters are Jesus signs his name of authority to Daniel's book. Jesus saying, I believe Daniel wrote the book of Daniel. You see, the great thing about that is you can tell your professor at Portland State or Oregon State or Berserkly or wherever you go to college. You can say, Mr. Professor, so do you know more than Jesus Christ knew about his book? You see, because Mr. Professor, if you disagree with Jesus, you got more troubles than just not believing Daniel was really. If you don't believe Jesus, then you've got. See, it gets into the real issue, and the real issue is who do you say Jesus Christ is? And really, quite frankly, most professors that I've bumped into aren't willing to say I know more than Jesus Christ. Now, if they do, then at least the rest of the class knows. Oh, that guy. See, there's all these Christian kids that go to college. And they're just listening to these professors going, oh wow, really questioning my faith. But as soon as a prof has to say, I really think Jesus was out to lunch on this one, at least it draws a line where most kids will go, maybe this guy's thinking he's a little too cool for school to say that he knows more than Christ. Are you following me there? That's really important because Daniel, the book of Daniel, is one of the most scrutinized books of all the Bible. Jesus signs his name to it. Now, abomination of desolation. Well, in the first version of the abomination of desolation, let me give you a little historical background. Antiochus, a world leader in ancient times. Antiochus the Fourth, the son of Antiochus the Great. Now, who was he? He was a Seleucid. That was back during the times in the 160s BC when the Ptolemies and the Seleucids were battling it out. But Antiochus came into power from the Syria, the north of Israel region. Antiochus the Fourth, who later called himself Antiochus Epiphanes. You say, well, Antiochus Epiphanes, some people call him Antiochus. Don't be confused, same guy. Antiochus Epiphanes, it's just that he believed he was like God. And so he called himself Antiochus the Shining Fourth One. That's the name he gave himself. Now, you know these world leaders that came with those names, you got to kind of wonder about. This guy was crazy, self-absorbed. He was one of the most sinful, wicked leaders. He was a despot, highly eccentric, totally an unreliable, cruel leader, this guy, Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, the word Epiphanes, interestingly enough, the Jews did a little play on words with Antiochus Epiphanes, and they called him Antiochus Epimanes. Now the funny thing is, and Epiphanes means the shining forth one. Epimanes means the madman. So they said, yes, Antiochus Epimanes, you know, and they would say that in history. There's actually writings that they actually changed that around. Now, Josephus tells us a lot about Antiochus Epiphanes and what happened. This guy undertook a total eradication of the Jewish religion, and he was willing to kill all the Jews if he had to get rid of the Jewish religion. Antiochus Epiphanes said if a male gets circumcised, that will cost him the death penalty. And so he had actually some of his soldiers go around checking males to see if they were circumcised or not. And if a man was circumcised, they would kill him on the spot. That's the kind of things Antiochus Epiphanes was known for, along with many other things. But here's what happened there in those times. He took over Jerusalem and committed what we would call the abomination of desolation, spoken of by the prophet Daniel. Daniel chapter 8, Daniel chapter 9, chapter 11, and chapter 12. But here's the thing. This first version of this in Jerusalem on the 15th of Chislev, which would be December, right around 168 BC, Antiochus broke a league that he had made with the Jews. Remember I told you earlier that he was a bad guy, but he was also unreliable? He would make promises to people, but then he would totally turn on those people and kill them all. One of those things, he did make a league, according to Josephus, in Antiquities, book 12, volume 4. He erected an idol to Zeus in the temple in Jerusalem and made people to worship there. Now, interestingly, this worshiping of idols, the Jews were either the ones that believed in God and would not defile themselves with this idolatry. They were either killed or they were in hiding while Antiochus was reigning. But he made people sacrifice swine, pigs, there in the temple, and he would smear pig's blood all over the temple walls, knowing the Jews, you know, a pig was a very unclean animal, and so he was just doing everything to spite the Jews historically. So there was one priest who was not giving in to this worshiping of Zeus and the temple of Jupiter. In fact, he called the Jews' temple in Jerusalem, he called it the Temple of Jupiter Olympius. And there was this one priest, Jewish priest. His name was Mattathias. And he would not give in to Antiochus's evil, wicked thing. And the very first Jew, true story, that actually went up the temple steps to the Temple Mount to worship Zeus, just cooperating with Antiochus, Mattathias killed him there, offing this Jew that was giving in to the worshiping of this false idol. Now, while I'm telling the story, understand the word abomination in the Bible is used over and over. It's always in reference to things that the Lord despises. One of the things the Lord over and over in the Word that He despises, does anybody, let's throw it out here for you Bible students. What is the one thing that God always calls an abomination? Okay, you're right. What did you say? Idols. Yep, Cody gets an A for the night. Idolatry, God always calls an abomination. Which, by the way, the sexual immorality that was around idolatry was also very much a part of that abomination. Now, the reason I say that is because that plays into this future event that is called the abomination of desolation. It does have to do with worshiping an image, an idol. Tuck that away. So, Mattathias, well, he's got five sons. One of his sons' name was Judas. Later, they gave him the name Judas Maccabeus, which means the hammer. They called him the hammer, this guy Judas, because he was as tough as nails. And this guy with his five brothers, they began a revolt. It started out as a revolt, and then it moved into sort of guerrilla-type warfare. where these Jewish sons, and these guys were, if you read about them in history, these guys were amazing soldiers, statisticians, man. These guys, not statisticians, strategists. They're over there with their numbers ticking on. No, wrong occupation. No, these guys were actually, in fact, people study their warfare to this day. But these guys, they started in revolt, then they had these military maneuvers that were amazing, and eventually began to put down Antiochus and his massive army. And it's one of the more amazing studies in history, the Maccabean Revolt. But you know the story. Eventually, Antiochus Epiphanes would be killed after he defiled the temple, set himself up to be worshipped, and made himself to be like a god, and did it in the Jewish temple. All that happened. Finally, he died. The Maccabean Revolt took over, and they were able to take back Jerusalem. Now, just a quick sideline freebie for you. The Maccabean guys and the Jews, they ended up lighting the candles in the temple. But the story goes where they didn't have enough oil for those candles to burn the proper length of time. And so they prayed, and the candles burnt miraculously long enough so that the temple would be cleansed. And those candles burned in their proper way without oil, and it became later the Festival of Lights, or later called Hanukkah. And that's what the Jews celebrate Hanukkah. It's about that Maccabean revolt. By the way, in the Gospel of John, there is a reference in John chapter 10, verse 22, to Hanukkah. So people that say Hanukkah has nothing to do with Christianity, it's actually wrong. It has a lot to do with Christianity, and it's talked about in the Bible. And when they were celebrating this Festival of Lights, that's right when Jesus said, "I am the light of the world." So there's some interesting implications about all that. But again, running out of time. Now, this abomination of desolation, first picture of that in history is a perfect description of what happened there in Jerusalem with Antiochus Epiphanes. You say, "Brett, so it already happened." Yes. But Jesus tells us here in Matthew 24, "When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel, when it stands in the holy place, whoso reads him, let him understand." In other words, this is going to be tricky for you guys. "Then let him which be in Judea flee to the mountains." So in the future, there's going to come a time where this abomination is going to be Act 2. Same exact thing. And so we read about it both in the book of Daniel, not the Antiochus story only, but also the future event that Daniel chapter 9 specifically talks about. Now, I need you to flip back to Daniel 9. We're almost done for tonight, so don't sweat. I'm not going to try to finish all of 24 tonight. But Daniel chapter 9, turn there real quick. The prophecy of the 70 weeks of Daniel speaks of this abomination of desolation, but not the Antiochus version, the one that's going to happen in the last days during the tribulation period. And we're going to see that articulated here. And it's for the Jewish people. Understand this. The abomination of desolation has to do with the Jewish temple. The warnings are going to be to the Jews, warning that it should not be on the Sabbath, which is the only people who really are affected with the Sabbath day, is the Jewish people. But here in Daniel 9, it says in let's start in verse 24. This prophecy was given to Daniel. Daniel 9, 24. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins. Question, has that stuff happened yet? The finishing of transgressions didn't happen because we all sinned today. So that's not so good. So that hasn't happened. So what we're talking about is something in the future. Making an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring into everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Again, by the way, amillennialists have a hard time because this hasn't happened yet. You cannot say everlasting righteousness has been brought in to the earth and an end of sin and an end of iniquity. That's something talked about in the future. Jesus is describing here for us the millennial kingdom in the future, where the lion will lay down with the lamb, you know, and the children will be able to play with pythons or with vipers and stuff. It's not going to be a bad time. Everything's going to be good in the kingdom. But it says here, now here's where it gets tricky, verse 25. "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and rebuild Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. We've done studies on this. If you missed it, pick up our MP3 or CD on Daniel 9, the prophecy of the 70 weeks of Daniel. But all that's to say, the time was determined when Christ would actually ride into Jerusalem. This is where Jesus said to the people, he said, oh, if you would have known in this thy day, when he was riding in Jerusalem, they were crying Hosanna, Palm Sunday. He said, you would have known, if you would have just known Daniel chapter 9, you could have known this thy day that your Messiah was coming. This is where they could have calculated out from the commandment to rebuild Jerusalem to the Messiah the Prince was those 7 weeks, 62 weeks, which the week in this case are a week of 7 years. But I don't need to get into all that. We've done studies on that. How many of you guys are familiar with the 70 weeks prophecy? Okay, good. If you're not, you probably should familiarize yourself. It's very important. But here's where it gets to this thing about the tribulation period. So it says, and in verse, the Messiah, the Prince, verse 25, shall be 7 weeks, 62 weeks, and the street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublous times. And after 62 weeks, shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. That's speaking of the crucifixion. At the end of the 69 weeks of Daniel, Messiah would be crucified, and the people of the prince, or the prince of the people is kind of the idea there, shall come and destroy the city and the sanctuary. And the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war, desolations are determined. Okay, so understand, 69 weeks have already happened. Messiah came, then he was died on a cross. Then there's this gap. There's the 70th week, or the 70th 7 year period is the idea there. There's a 7 year period hanging out here in the future somewhere. And you say, well, Brett, what's the variable in here? Well, when Christ died on the cross, stopwatch stops. And there's a whole new age that's brought in after Christ died on the cross and rose from the grave. It was the age of the church. And by the way, people that say the church is going to be in the 70th week, or that 7 year period of the tribulation, you got a problem with Daniel chapter 9, because if we, the church, weren't in the first 69 weeks of Daniel's 70 weeks, why would we be in the 70th week of Daniel's 70 weeks? We're not going to be here, and I'll tell you why. We're going to be taken out because we're not appointed to wrath. But we're going to be raptured and not going to be here. That's my opinion. It makes perfect sense when you compare Daniel's 70th week. Now, during this last week, we get a description of what's going to happen during the 7 year period called the tribulation, and when this abomination thing's going to come down. How's that going to look? Check it out. Verse 26 in the middle, we read, the people of the prince, or the prince of the people, shall come and destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of war, desolations are determined. And he, this is this world leader, the prince of the people, the Antichrist, verse 27, shall confirm the covenant with many. The covenant is this peace treaty we've talked about that this world leader is going to set in the last days with Israel. That's going to be this covenant that's going to seem to be peaceable, but it's going to be tricky. It says, he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, for 7 years. And in the midst, what's the midst? The middle. In the middle of that week, he shall cause the sacrifice and oblations to cease, and for the overspreading of the abominations, he shall make it desolate. There it is, the abomination of desolation, even until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. Now, again, this is a lot of stuff to cover in one evening, but let me just put it this way. Daniel says that in the middle of the 70th week, that 7 year period called the tribulation, the middle point, book of Revelation even defines the years, 3.5 years, then the Antichrist, this world leader, will set himself just like Antiochus Epiphanes of 160-something BC. That's what he's going to do in the tribulation period. The Antichrist is going to come, go into the temple that will be rebuilt during the tribulation, the Bible says. He'll go in there to set himself up to be worshipped, and he will set up his image to be worshipped there in the temple. What's his image? We'll talk about that next week. Now you say, okay, Brett, so this world leader, Jesus is talking about sort of a second fulfillment of this prophecy. Because we know Antiochus happened before Christ. Christ is now saying, watch out, there's one still coming. What's the point of all this? Why is there going to be this abomination of desolation? And what are the Jews going to do? And what does that have to do with me and us? And more importantly, it says they're going to flee to the wilderness. Where is that wilderness, and why are they going to flee? I mean, there's a lot of questions that we still have that Jesus is going to answer next week for us in our study. So we'll get there, Lord willing.